Welcome to Mayo Clinic Pharmacy Grand Rounds, a weekly podcast for pharmacists, physicians, physician assistants, and nurse practitioners who are interested in learning more about clinical pharmacology topics. I'm your host, Garrett Schramm, Director of Pharmacy Education and Academic Affairs at Mayo Clinic. To claim pharmacology CE credit or to get a copy of presentation slides, visit ce.mayo.edu/pharmacypodcast. Approximately 11% of Americans use antidepressants, with selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, or SSRIs, being the most common treatment choice. In the event a patient experiences an overdose, clinicians may be faced with acute decisions to decrease the incidence of serotonin syndrome, neurotoxicity, and possibly cardiotoxicity. Dr. Casey O'Connell, a clinical pharmacist at Mayo Clinic, walks us through a hypothetical patient case to manage an SSRI overdose with a focus on pharmacologic interventions.
Thank you, Garrett, for the introduction. As Garrett just mentioned, I do have a little bit of an atypical pathway into pharmacy, and that prior to working as a pharmacist, I was an ICU nurse. And actually, on my very first day of working as an ICU nurse, I'll never forget it, because I took care of a patient who came in and suffered an SSRI overdose. This is something that stuck with me for the entirety of my nursing career and into my pharmacy education and through today. I'm fascinated by SSRI overdoses because we have a medication that causes such good in a lot of people that are suffering, but it completely changes in the setting of an overdose. And so before we get into our objectives, I just want to bring up this quote. This is from Paracelsus. He was a Swiss physician, and he's considered the founder of modern toxicology. And he said that all things are poison, and nothing is without poison. The dosage alone makes it so a thing is not a poison. So just kind of something we can keep in the back of our minds when we talk about toxicology today, and where do we draw that fine line between therapeutic treatment and poisoning? For objectives today, I hope to review potential toxicities associated with an acute SSRI overdose. Beyond that, I would also like to identify pharmacological interventions that we as providers can make to help care for patients who present with an acute SSRI overdose. And last, I'd like to review a patient case pertaining to the management of an acute SSRI overdose. Our patient case somewhat paralleled the patient that I saw years ago. Before we get into it, though, let's talk a little bit about the background of depression and antidepressant use today. So there's some data from Pratt and colleagues that came out in 2011. It was actually based on data from 2005 through 2008 that said that approximately 11% of Americans aged 12 and over use antidepressants or had filled a prescription for an antidepressant in the previous year. This goes to show that antidepressant use is very common, and they also commented on how it has increased. In fact, they mentioned that by the year 2020, if the trend continues, about 13% of people will be on antidepressants. And this is not a bad thing, necessarily. I think what's more important is that we're treating depression, so not making any comments on that. But this is just to drive home just how common these medications are and how much availability there is. Going along with that, there are greater than 52,000 SSRI overdoses every year in the U.S. About 30,000 of these are polysubstance overdoses, where an SSRI is included with another substance. About 22,000, the SSRI is the only agent identified in the overdose. Just to drive home the point of the prevalence of SSRIs, we've got FDA-approved indications for SSRIs here, things that we're very familiar with, major depressive disorder, generalized anxiety disorder. It's first line for both of those disease states, and then a lot of these other ones we're probably familiar with. There's also some other ones, though, that we might be less familiar with, personality disorders, eating disorders, neuropathic pain, even speech disorders. This goes to show that SSRI use is expanding not only because there's depression, but also because we're finding new and unique ways to use these medications. So let's get into the patient case. Here we have a patient who presents to the emergency department with altered mental status as her chief complaint. She's a 25-year-old female, and she's coming in about 12 hours after initially ingesting an unknown quantity of both fluoxetine and citalopram. You do a little cursory chart review, and you see that she has major depressive disorder, PTSD, migraine, and she was recently treated for a UTI. You also identify some social history and that she's a one-pack-per-day smoker, and she's got non-contributory family history. Taking a peek at her medication list, you see that she was recently prescribed ciprofloxacin for her UTI, and she's taking citalopram and quetiapine for depression, as well as ondansetron for nausea associated with her migraines and sumatriptan as an abortive therapy. You'll note that fluoxetine is not listed on this med list, but just like in the patient that I saw years ago, that was not one of her current meds. It was actually a holdover from a previous prescription that she still had access to because of poor adherence. And so this will bring us to our first poll F question. So if you want to take this opportunity to bring out your devices, your smartphones, tablets, and you can go to pollev.com/MayoRx, and you can start to answer our question here. So which medication from the patient's medication list has an overlapping toxicity with a fluoxetine and citalopram overdose? So we've got some results coming in. We got some people changing their minds. I like that. That's good. And so it looks like we do have a plurality, though, and most people agree with E, all of the above. And in this circumstance, I would also agree with E. Ciprofloxacin has a potential for QT prolongation, which we can see with some SSRIs. Ondansetron can also prolong our QT and actually has some endogenous serotonergic activity itself. Quetiapine is another QT prolonger. And then sumatriptan also has serotonergic activity. So you can make an argument for all these medications. And that also kind of drives home that this is a pretty common med list for a 25-year-old female, and every single one of them had some overlap. So a lot of things to consider when you have a patient with an SSRI overdose. So just to kind of orient ourselves with the pathophys, here we have a presynaptic nerve on top, and we've got our postsynaptic nerve on bottom. So we're in the CNS right now, and we've got serotonin is these gray spheres in the middle, and our serotonin receptor at the postsynaptic nerve is this kind of orange Pac-Man looking shape here. So in a normal scenario, our serotonin is going to be released from these vacuoles. We'll go down and we'll have our magic green lightning bolts. It'll be serotonergic activity following the postsynaptic nerve. So this happens on the order of microseconds. And at the same time, the serotonin is hitting that postsynaptic nerve. We also have other molecules that are being taken back up after previously hitting it. So we have our uptake transporter there in the middle. In a patient with depression, our current model of the disease is that we don't have enough serotonergic activity. So we don't have enough of our green lightning bolts in the simplified model. So we use things like SSRIs, TCAs, bupropion, and we block the uptake transporter. In our case today, we're going to be talking mostly about SSRIs, but this is where the serotonergic activity of all of these medications, plus some of the synthetic opioids like fentanyl and tramadol, takes place. There are other mechanisms of serotonergic activity as well, though. For example, we have serotonin agonism that's direct serotonin agonism at the level of the postsynaptic nerve. This would be things like triptans and buspirone, which bypass serotonin itself and have that postsynaptic activity. We can also have increased release. This happens with medications like cocaine, amphetamines, mirtazapine, and buspirone, which just increase the amount of serotonin in the synapse. Lastly, we have decrease of breakdown. So monoamine oxidase is what's responsible for breaking down serotonin, and if we inhibit that or give drugs that have inhibitory activity like linezolid or methylene blue, we can increase the amount of serotonin as well. So in our case today, we basically have a patient who's got a lot of our purple purple rectangle, but you can see that in some patient cases, you can have synergy among these different mechanisms that result in increased green lightning bolts on bottom. So in our scenario here, this is serotonin syndrome. So talking about the toxicology of SSRI overdose, there's serotonin syndrome, neurotoxicity, and cardiac toxicity. To give you kind of a brief primer on these three aspects that we can see, serotonin syndrome is marked by altered mental status, autonomic hyperactivity, and muscular clonus. Neurotoxicity can have a couple different components to it. There can be direct CNS depression, and in some agents we can have seizure. And then lastly, there's cardiotoxicity. This is among the more rare side effects, but we can have QT interval prolongation, and we can also have QRS widening. So popping back to our patient case, our patient came into the ED, and then after being triaged, we note that she is agitated, flushed, febrile, and she's noted to have ocular myoclonus. The consultant and senior resident are in the resuscitation bay, and an intern approaches you for some help. The intern wants to know about some differential diagnoses that could be in play here, what monitoring we should take a look at, and if there's any medications that we can utilize in treating our patient with an SSRI overdose. So I'll kind of orient you here to our Venn diagram. We'll start in the middle with things that serotonin syndrome and NMS have in common, because when you're talking differential diagnoses of serotonin syndrome, NMS is going to be one of the first things that comes up because of this big overlap. These are both what they call hot stiff conditions, or you might hear referred to as. That's because in both circumstances, you have patients with hyperthermia, you have increased vital signs, hypertension, tachycardia, and tachypnea, and patients, if just at a glance, are stiff. Now we'll kind of look at the comparison from side to side, and we'll go serotonin syndrome to neuroleptic malignant syndrome. So some of the differences between the two is that serotonin syndrome is obviously result from serotonergic exposure. This is different from NMS, which comes from dopamine antagonism. Serotonin syndrome is also much faster in that it comes within 24 hours of exposure, whereas NMS is a little bit more insidious, happening over an order of days to weeks. Serotonin syndrome can also start with agitation, although it can end in coma, whereas NMS is more likely to have a stupor and alert mutism. And then as far as kind of the stiff presentation, serotonin syndrome is a little bit different and it's more of a hyperreflexia and clonus, whereas NMS is just that lead pipe rigidity. They're not moving, they're not cycling their muscle contraction and relaxation, they're just completely stiff. You also have a difference in bowel tone between the two, in that serotonin syndrome will have hyperactive bowel sounds, and NMS you'll see hypoactive or maybe normal bowel sounds. As far as actually getting a diagnosis of serotonin syndrome, though, you have to look at Hunter's criteria. So to have a positive diagnosis of serotonin syndrome, the first thing you need is serotonergic exposure. That's something that you have to have. So up front, we have serotonergic exposure, and then you need additional criteria. And it can be a little complicating, especially when you first look at it, because you've got a lot of ands and ors and things like that. So you have your serotonergic exposure, and then you need at least one of the following: spontaneous clonus, hypertonia, tremor and hyperreflexia, inducible clonus and agitation or diaphoresis, ocular clonus and agitation or diaphoresis, and then our last one is a patient who's febrile above 38 degrees centigrade and ocular clonus or inducible clonus. In our patient case, we have our serotonergic exposure, and then we also meet two criteria, so kind of going above and beyond. We have ocular clonus and agitation, and then we also have a febrile patient with ocular clonus. So just to kind of drive that point home. With regards to monitoring, so to answer our intern's second question, in most circumstances, we're going to be getting our vital signs up front. That's obvious. And in the ED, a lot of people are going to get that baseline 12-lead ECG, and we're going to be drawing labs. I'll draw your attention to the labs in particular here, because in an ingestion like this, even though there is no acetaminophen or anything else on the patient's home med list, we're always going to be looking for common co-ingested drugs like acetaminophen, salicylates, and ethanol. It's important to rule these out, and like I showed you before, a lot of these patients are going to have polysubstance ingestions. In a more complicated patient case or a late presenter, the Minnesota Poison Center also recommends drawing some additional labs. In this case, you might have a more emergent presentation, or you need to rule out things like infectious processes. So we can get a head CT, a lumbar puncture to help rule out meningitis, and then additional labs to kind of establish your patient's hemodynamics. A QTC interval monitoring is also important when you have a patient who's a late presenter, and we'll get into that in a little bit. So our last question that our intern asked us was about management. And so briefly, for serotonin syndrome management in particular, the basis of treatment is removing our serotonergic agents. This is obvious, but when you think about some of the medications that we frequently use in the ED, a lot of these patients can end up getting intubated. One of our meds that we use in that scenario could be fentanyl, but earlier we talked about how fentanyl does have serotonergic activity. So not only do we need to remove those meds, but we also need to make sure that we don't give them ourselves. And then benzodiazepine administration and good supportive care is also going to be very important in these patients. If you've had any contact with a poison center, you'll know that they love benzodiazepines, and when in doubt, give a heavy dose of them. And for most patients, you can actually draw the line right here. With good supportive care and removal of serotonergic agents, a lot of these patients are going to get better within 24 hours. However, in the case of polysubstance overdoses or late presenters or patients with massive overdoses that are coming in very sick, we have some additional steps that we need to consider. So the first one is gastric decontamination. This would be if you had like a massive overdose that was within the last hour. That's pretty much the only scenario where you're going to consider giving activated charcoal in the patient, just because the risk of aspiration quickly outweighs the benefits. You can also consider paralytic and intubation. This would be in a patient that's especially hyperthermic and is kind of going down a rhabdomyolysis type pathway. And these patients' paralyzing them decreases that muscular clonus and can help lower the temperature. Tylenol actually doesn't do anything in these patients for temperature, I should also note. And then lastly, there's a medication, cyproheptadine. Some of us might be familiar with it, but it's an antihistamine that's got some anticholinergic activity as well. And it's something that in a patient with serotonin syndrome, we occasionally reach for. And so let's get into that a little bit. So cyproheptadine, I mentioned that it's an antihistamine. You know, most first-generation antihistamines have some anticholinergic activity, whether we like it or not. But cyproheptadine is a little different in that it also has serotonin antagonism, especially at high doses. An interesting caveat about this medication is that it's not available IV. So if you're going to give it to a patient, they have to be able to take it orally, or you need the NG tube. So kind of another consideration in an acute patient. We're going to be giving 12 milligrams up front, and then you can give 2 milligrams every 2 hours initially, or you can do kind of 4 to 8 milligrams every 6 hours for a maintenance type dose. And really, this medication should only be considered in moderate to severe cases, in part because of adverse drug events like sedation, confusion, and hypotension, but also because of some of the evidence behind it. So I'll show you about how cyproheptadine works here. I mentioned that it's a serotonin antagonist. So just to reorient you to our model that we established earlier, we have our presynaptic nerve on top, our postsynaptic nerve on bottom, and we've got a bunch of our gray spheres here that are representing serotonin. We also have our purple rectangle back showing that we've got blockade of our uptake transporter, which is why we have all of our green lightning bolts representing serotonin syndrome. So in this case, we've got a patient with serotonin syndrome, and we administer cyproheptadine. We give the drug, and it outcompetes serotonin at the site of the serotonin receptor, kicks it off, and then you see our green lightning bolts starting to disappear. This is how this situation should ideally go, and that it should outcompete it and decrease the serotonergic output. However, looking at some of the data behind cyproheptadine, it does leave a little bit to be desired. In fact, the basis of cyproheptadine use in serotonin syndrome is actually an in vivo study by Kapoor and colleagues that only included 2 healthy adult male volunteers. Neither of these gentlemen were known to be taking any serotonergic medications. And basically what they did in this study is they gave one of them 4 milligrams TID for 6 days. They gave the other one 6 milligrams TID for 6 days. And they put them under a PET scan before and after to evaluate the serotonin receptor occupation. The patient that was taking 4 milligrams TID had about 85% receptor blocking per the PET scan, while the other one taking 6 milligrams TID had about 95% or a little bit above receptor blocking. So this is great that we see that this medication works in this aspect, but we get absolutely no clinical information about this. And in fact, since this study came out in 1997, so over 20 years ago, we still don't have any well-designed prospective clinical trials to support the use of cyproheptadine. So the takeaway is that cyproheptadine definitely does have some adverse effects, but in a situation where we do have a moderate to severe serotonin syndrome type presentation, it is reasonable to consider. So jumping back to our patient case. Using Hunter's criteria, our intern that we just kind of educated ends up diagnosing our patient with serotonin syndrome and enters orders to obtain a 12-lead EKG, draw some labs, start fluids, and place the patient on 1-on-1 observation for suicidality. So he's doing everything by the book right now. However, minutes later, the patient has a tonic-clonic seizure. So we can get our devices out again and just kind of set a baseline here. What do you think you would choose as your initial treatment option for this patient's seizure that's presenting in this mechanism? So it looks like the audience today has selected lorazepam, and I would agree with that. In this question, I don't think that there's a firm right or wrong answer, although I think that in most scenarios, lorazepam is a good choice because it's fast on, it can be given IV, And it can, in general, be used to treat other aspects of serotonin syndrome as well. So no true right or wrong answer, but I do agree I would probably reach for lorazepam first. So let's transition to talking about this neurotoxicity component in SSRI overdose. I mentioned earlier there's two different kind of separate components. One's a CNS depression from it, and the other is seizures. And CNS depression is kind of easier to wrap your head around because it's more of an extension of the pharmacological activity of an SSRI. Some patients on SSRIs, when you go to counseling, they might let them know that they might have some CNS depression, they might be tired, things like that. Perhaps they'll want to dose it at night. Just like that, in overdose, we can see an extension of this and have patients that are very drowsy and need to be intubated just to protect their airway from that. However, there are some patients that can also suffer seizures in overdose. And this is definitely most common in citalopram and escitalopram overdose, which has a dose-related risk increase with toxicity. Although I will mention that typically this is only noted in concentrations about 40 times therapeutic levels. So even though it's real and it's observed, it's something that shouldn't scare away use of SSRIs because you do need to take a very large quantity. As far as management, I mentioned that first thing you're probably going to reach for is benzodiazepines. So these recommendations come from the Minnesota Poison Center, and they recommend lorazepam 2 to 8 milligrams IV every 10 to 15 minutes PRN. This is a little bit different from neurocritical care guidelines for initial seizure management and for status epilepticus, although the takeaway from this that I want is that it shouldn't be that different from normal care. Standard treatment of seizures should prevail here, and it's just important that they're managed up front. If you do have a refractory seizure-type patient, the Poison Center also recommends agents like phenobarbital, propofol, and then neuromuscular blockade and intubation, again, to decrease the patient's temperature and risk of rhabdo. I know I've mentioned rhabdo a couple times, and I just want to back up and talk about how this can result in these patients. So we talked earlier about serotonin syndrome has myoclonus. So we have rapid cycling between muscle contraction and relaxation. This helps drive up hyperthermia, which always lowers our seizure threshold as well. Plus, if our patient took a medication like citalopram, that is also going to lower our seizure threshold. So in a patient that does have seizures, we have rapid cycling of muscle contraction, and now we have overt seizures on top. What this leads to is severe muscle breakdown, myoglobin release, and then you have the potential for rhabdo. Again, this is by no means common, but I think it underscores the importance of early management and judicious benzodiazepine use and supportive care. So we'll pop back into our patient case. After the seizure, our patient is intubated and admitted to the medical ICU. Later that day, a repeat ECG is ordered, and the following results are noted. So we have a rate of 96, QRS of 90, and a corrected QT interval of 541. So our final poll question of the day, if you want to pull out your devices one more time and go to poll Ev, our question is, what medication will you administer if our patient develops torsades? And it looks like for today, we are, for the first time, in complete agreement that we're going to reach for magnesium sulfate in this patient. So great job. So this brings us to kind of the third aspect of toxicity within an SSRI overdose, and that's cardiotoxicity. So the first part of cardiotoxicity that we'll mention is QT interval prolongation. Now this is generally defined as a QTC greater than 500 milliseconds because that's when our association with torsades is most elevated. This risk is also elevated when you have a baseline prolonged QT or if you have co-ingestion of other QT prolonging medications. Kind of different from our neurotoxicity and our serotonin syndrome, this can be a little bit more of a delayed effect, and there are case studies that I cited at the bottom where this QT prolongation can happen more on the order of like 24 hours, and that's when you see the torsades deployed. So that's something to keep in mind. And again, our problem children in this circumstance are also citalopram and escitalopram. So those kind of keep popping up across the slides. As far as treatment, like we established a little bit ago, magnesium sulfate is what we're going to reach for. In a non-cardiac arrest type scenario, we can infuse a 100 milliliter bag over 15 minutes, or in cardiac arrest, we can just give it IV push. In this scenario, we don't need to have a baseline magnesium level, It's not likely that we're going to cause hypermagnesemia in a patient, and really we need to treat what's more important, and that's the prolonged QT in patients. There are some adverse effects with magnesium treatment, including hypotension, CNS depression, and flushing that we need to keep in mind, but like we established, this is what I would reach for too. As far as the mechanism of QRS widening, though, so this is the other aspect of cardiotoxicity. So here we have our cardiac myocytes that are the yellow ovals, and we've got our blue brackets, which are voltage-gated, fast-on sodium channels. So sodium is going to be represented by our green circles. We've got our SSRIs again popping up as our purple rectangles, and then we'll see bicarbonate in the last one. So in a normal scenario, sodium is going to go through the channels, and we're going to result in a normal QRS process. We've got a nice narrow QRS there, what we'd like to see. However, in an extreme SSRI overdose, so huge amounts of SSRIs, we can get something that's actually reminiscent of more like a TCA overdose, where we have altered conformation of our sodium channels. In this circumstance, our sodium has a little bit harder time kind of bopping around the channel there, and what that results in is a wider QRS process. This can increase our risk of ventricular arrhythmia. So what we can do is we can administer bicarbonate so that when we have our altered conformation, it's thinking about twisting, our bicarb can come in and kind of stabilize the channel, causing our sodium flow to once again be normal and result in a narrow QRS process. So again, this is in more massive ingestions, and I don't want you to think that this is common in SSRI overdoses, although there are case study reports of it. But if this scenario does pop up, we can give sodium bicarbonate 1 to 2 milliequivalents per kilogram as boluses until we do observe narrowing. And once we do observe narrowing, we can follow with a maintenance infusion. And the reason this works is because we're providing a sodium load, so we're kind of overwhelming that altered sodium channel, so just kind of overwhelming that process, allowing sodium to flow. But we're also increasing the pH, which does displace some of the SSRI molecules and kind of straightens it out a little bit more. So a couple different mechanisms how we can correct SSRI effects on the channels with sodium bicarbonate. Again, though, we do have to be careful because sodium bicarb can cause extravasation. If we overshoot, we can cause alkalosis, we can cause hypernatremia, and kind of everything else that comes with too much sodium. So the last thing that we'll kind of take a peek into is intravenous lipid use in SSRI overdose. So this is something that in toxicology has gained a little bit of traction over the last couple decades, but was first utilized back in 1962. The thought process behind it is that by giving lipids, you can actually make an intravascular lipid sink and basically an area for lipophilic drugs to partition into and then be eliminated. This is historically used in anesthetic toxicity. However, its use has expanded to other lipophilic medications. There have been some studies about its use in the context of SSRI overdose, and we'll get into these real quick. Aaron Sevich and colleagues had a case series where they talked about 10 adult overdoses where they gave intravenous lipids. In these overdoses, 7 of them were on antidepressants or overdose on antidepressants, but only 2 of them included SSRIs. Both patients that overdosed on SSRIs were also part of polypharmacy overdoses, so there were other lipophilic drugs in the pictures. 9 of the 10 patients overall survived their overdoses after receiving intravenous lipids, and they noted improvements in Glasgow Coma Scale, heart rate, and blood pressure in most of the patients immediately after giving the lipids. There were some patients that developed adverse drug events like high amylase levels and lung infiltration. However, neither of these patients ended up expiring from their overdoses. I think the takeaway, though, from this study is that only 2 of these included SSRIs, and in both of these patients, there were a lot of other drugs, though. So not totally convinced that we have a role for intravenous lipids yet, but we do have one more study. Perk and colleagues also described a single adult polypharmacy overdose where a patient ingested more than 400 milligrams of citalopram and was found to be in refractory status epilepticus, had a prolonged QTC of 570 milliseconds, and developed VTAC. In this patient, intravenous lipids were infused and they didn't note any adverse drug effects. And actually, shortly after infusing the lipids, they had resolution of seizures, they had resolution of the VTAC, and the patient was actually extubated just 24 hours later. So this is a case that it sounds kind of compelling to use the intravenous lipids in SSRI overdose. But again, this is only one patient. They had citalopram plus other medications. And we do have to consider publication bias too. You have to wonder how many other times there were providers that gave intravenous lipids and didn't have these kind of wonderful events and just didn't end up publishing. So the takeaway from this is that at this point in time, I think the role for intravenous lipids is maybe in a polypharmacy overdose in which you have SSRIs, and only in absolutely extreme circumstances where patients are refractory. By this point in time, I've talked about all of these toxicities related to SSRI overdoses, and I hope that I haven't scared you away from recommending these drugs and prescribing them, because really, they are quite safe in overdose. It's important to talk about these different mechanisms so we know how to best treat these patients. However, SSRI overdose is much safer than TCA overdose or MAOIs, which we used to use. In general, SSRIs have minimal interactions with other targets, and about 15% of patients will develop serotonin syndrome in overdose, while only 5% will require intubation. About 2% will develop seizures, and less than 1% will have a lethal outcome. Buhn and colleagues also looked into the safety of SSRI overdose, and they did a retrospective chart review where they talked about, or they looked at deliberate multidrug overdoses. In their study, they identified 148 patients who had a multidrug overdose that included SSRIs, and 296 patients that had multidrug overdoses that did not include SSRIs. During their study, they found that there was actually more serotonin syndrome than was diagnosed in the charts by going over Hunter's criteria themselves, but they found no difference in arrhythmia. They did, however, confirm that there was an increased number of seizures and an increased likelihood of intubation. You can see our p-values there. So this kind of brings us to our summary and overcap of SSRI overdose. Really, the takeaways I want you to take from this is that you manage this overdose by stopping serotonergic agents, by giving benzos liberally, and supportive care up front. If a patient does happen to develop seizures, continue with high-dose benzodiazepines, and you can manage ECG changes with intravenous magnesium and sodium bicarbonate as guided by the EKG. There's minimal evidence to support cyproheptadine use for serotonin syndrome, although it is reasonable in a moderate to severe case. And really, there's not much evidence to support intravenous lipids outside of a polysubstance overdose where SSRIs are in the context of other lipophilic medications. So just to wrap everything up, on hospital day two, our patient is no longer showing signs of serotonin syndrome and is extubated without any incident. Later that day, a repeat ECG demonstrates a QTC of 475, and our patient is subsequently discharged to inpatient psych. While recovering, a note is placed in her chart to avoid all serotonergic agents for several weeks based on the fluoxetine hanging around.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to hear more, subscribe using iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. Thank you for listening to Mayo Clinic Pharmacy Grand Rounds. Join us weekly for more exciting clinical pharmacology topics.